time.
Matt held up the staff, showing them where to grip it, then put them through the blocking practice his father had shown him back when he had been young enough to think fighting might actually be fun. He worked up a sweat, hitting at each of the new recruits in turn, forcing each to block.
"Burn me, but you will figure this out," Matt said loudly to all of them. "I wouldn't care so much as you lot seem to have the wits of stumps, but if you get yourselves killed, your mothers will be expecting me to send them word. I won't do it, mind you, but I might feel a little guilty between games of dice, and I hate feeling guilty, so pay attention."
"Lord Cawthon," said the lad who had given him the staff.
"I'm not..."
He stopped.
"Well, yes, what is it?"
"Can't we just learn the sword?"
"Light," Matt said. "What's your name?"
"Sigmont, sir."
"Well, Sigmont, how much time do you think we have? Maybe you could wander out, talk to the Dreadlords and the Shadowspawn, and ask them to give me a few more months' time, so I can train you all properly."
Sigmont blushed, and Matt handed back his staff.
"City boys," he sighed. "Look here. All I want is for you lot to be able to defend yourselves. I don't have time to make you great warriors, but I can teach you to work together, keep a formation, and not shy away when the Trollocs come. That will get you farther than any kind of fancy swordplay, trust me."
The youths nodded reluctantly.
"Get back to your practice," Matt said, wiping his brow and looking over his shoulder.
"Bloody ashes."
The Death Watch guards were heading his way. He grabbed his Ashendari and rushed off, then ducked around the side of a tent, only to stumble into a group of Aes Sedai approaching on the path.
"Matt?"
Egwene asked from the middle of the group of women.
"Are you well?"
"They're bloody chasing me," he said, glancing around the side of the tent.
"Who is chasing you?"
Egwene said.
"Death Watch guards," Matt said. "I'm supposed to be back at Tuon's tent."
Egwene waved a few fingers, sending the other women off except her two shadows, Gawain and that Seanchan woman, who remained with her.
"Matt,"
Egwene said in a suffering tone,
"I'm glad you finally decided to see reason and leave the Seanchan camp. But couldn't you have waited until after the battle was over to defect?"
"Sorry,"
he said, only half listening.
"But can we walk on toward the Aes Sedai quarter of camp? They won't follow me there."
"Maybe not.
If all Death Watch guards were like Kareed, maybe they would.
Kareed would dive after a man falling off a cliff in order to catch him."
Egwene started back, seeming displeased with Matt.
How was it Aes Sedai could be so perfectly emotionless, yet still let a man know they disapproved of him?
Come to think of it, an Aes Sedai would probably follow a man off a cliff too, if only to explain to him, in detail, all the things he was doing incorrectly in the way he went about killing himself.
Matt wished so many of his thoughts lately did not involve feeling like he was the one jumping off the cliff.
"We'll have to find a way to explain to Fortuona why you ran," Egwene said as they approached the Aes Sedai quarter.
Matt had placed it as far from the Seanchan as was reasonable.
"The marriage is going to present a problem. I suggest that you..."
"Wait, Egwene," Matt said.
"What are you talking about?" "You are running from the Seanchan guards," Egwene said. "Weren't you listening?"
"Of course you weren't.
It is pleasant to know that as the world crumbles, a few things are completely unchangeable. Gwendolyn and Matt Cawthon."
"I'm running from them," Matt said, looking over his shoulder, "because Tuon wants me to sit in judgment. Any time a soldier is seeking the Empress's mercy for a crime, I'm the one who is supposed to bloody hear his case."
"You," Egwene said, "passing judgment?"
"I know," Matt said. "Too much bloody work, if you ask me. I've been dodging guardsmen all day, trying to steal a little time for myself."
"A little honest work wouldn't kill you, Matt."
"Now, you know that's not true. Soldiering is honest work, and it gets men killed all the bloody time."
Gawain Trakand was apparently practicing to be an Aes Sedai sometime, because he kept giving Matt glares that would have made Moiraine proud. Well, let him. Gawain was a prince. He had been raised to do things like pass judgment. He probably sent a few men to the gallows each day at his lunch break, just to keep in practice. But Matt... Matt was not going to order men to be executed, and that was that. They passed a group of Aiel sparring together. Was this group what Urien had been running to reach? Once they had passed, Matt trying to make the others walk faster so the Shonchan would not catch up, he drew closer to Egwene.
"Have you found it yet?" he asked softly.
"No,"
Egwene said, eyes forward. No need to mention what it was.
"How could you have lost the thing? After all the bloody work we went through to find it."
"We?"
"From the telling I hear, Rand, Loyal, and the Borderlanders had far more to do with finding it than you."
"I was there," Matt said. "I rode across the entire bloody continent, didn't I? Burn me, first Rand, then you. Is everybody going to chivvy me about those days? Gawain, you want a turn?"
"Yes, please," he sounded eager.
"Shut up," Matt said. "It seems that nobody can remember straight but me. I hunted down that bloody horn like a madman, and, I'll mention, it was me blowing the thing that let you all escape Falma."
"Is that how you remember it?"
Egwene asked.
"Sure," Matt said. "I mean, I have some holes in there, but I pieced it mostly together."
"And the dagger?"
"That trinket? Hardly worth anyone's time."
He caught himself reaching to his side, to where he had once carried it. Egwene raised an eyebrow at him.
"Anyway, that's not the point. We're going to need that bloody instrument, Egwene. We'll need it."
"We have people searching," she said. "We're not sure exactly what happened. There was a traveling residue, but it's been a while, and... Light, Matt, we're trying, I promise it. It's not the only thing the Shadow has stolen from us recently."
He glanced at her, but she gave him no more. "Flaming Aes Sedai? Has anyone seen Perrin yet?" he asked. "I don't want to be the one to tell him his wife has gone missing."
"Nobody has seen him," Egwene said. "I assume he is at work helping Rand."
"Bah," Matt said. "Can you make a gateway for me up to the top of the knob?"
"I thought you wanted to go to my camp."
"It's on the way," Matt said.
Well, sort of, it was.
"And those Death Watch guards won't expect it. Burn me, Egwene, but I think they've guessed where we're heading."
Egwene, after pausing for a moment, opened them a gateway to the traveling ground atop the knob. They stepped through onto it. More than a hill, less than a mountain, Dashar Knob rose a good 100 feet into the air near the middle of the battlefield. The rock formation was unscalable, and gateways were the only way to reach the top. From here, Matt and his commanders would be able to watch the entire battle play out.
"I have never known anyone else," Egwene said to him, "who will work so hard to avoid hard work, Matrim Cawthin."
"You haven't spent enough time around soldiers,"
Matt waved at the men who saluted him as he walked out of the traveling grounds. He looked north toward the River Mora, and across it into Arafel, then northeast toward the ruins of what had once been some kind of fort or watchtower, eastward toward the rising palisade in the forest. He continued to turn, southward to gaze at the River Aranin in the far distance, and the strange little grove of tall trees that Loyal was in so awe of. They said Rand had grown those during the meeting where the treaty had been signed. Matt looked southwest toward the only good ford on the Mora nearby, named Howall Ford, by the locals who had farmed this area. Beyond the ford, on the Arafel side, was a large expanse of bogs. Westward, across the Mora, lay Polov Heights, a 40-foot-tall plateau with a steep slope on the east and more gradual slopes on the other sides. Between the base of the southwestern slope and the bogs was a corridor roughly 200 paces across, well worn by travelers who used the ford to cross between Arafel and Shinar. Matt could use these features to his advantage. He could use them all. Would that be enough? He could feel something pulling on him, tugging him northward. Rand would need him soon. He turned, ready to bolt as someone approached across the top of the knob, but it was not the Death Watch guards. It was just leather-faced Jur Grady.
"I fetched those soldiers for you,"
Grady said, pointing. Matt could see a small force coming through a gateway to the traveling grounds near the palisade. 100 men of the band, led by Dalarn, flying a bloody red flag. The Red Arms were accompanied by some 500 people in worn clothing.
"What was the point of this?"
Grady asked.
"You sent those 100 to a village in the south to recruit, I assume?"
"That and more." "I saved your life, man," Matt thought, trying to pick Dalarn out of the group. "And then you volunteer for this? Bloody fool." Dalarn acted as if it were his fate.
"Take them upriver," Matt said. "The maps show there is only one good place to block the Mora, a narrow canyon a few leagues northeast of here."
"All right," Grady said. "There will be channelers involved."
"You will have to handle them," Matt said. "Mostly, though, I want you to let those 600 men and women defend the river. Don't risk yourself too much. Let Dalarn and his people do the work."
"Pardon?"
Grady said. "But that doesn't seem like a very large force. Most of them aren't trained soldiers."
"I know what I'm doing," Matt said. "I hope." Grady nodded reluctantly and moved off. Egwene watched Matt with curious eyes.
"We can't fall back from this fight," Matt said softly. "We don't retreat. There isn't anywhere to go. We stand here, or we lose it all."
"There is always a retreat," Egwene said.
"No," Matt said. "Not anymore."
He rested his Ashendari on his shoulder, his other hand out, palm forward. He scanned the landscape, memories appearing as if from light and dust before him. Ryan on Hewn Hill. Nath and the Sandamah Shadar. The fall of Pipkin. Hundreds upon hundreds of battlefields, hundreds of victories, thousands of deaths. Matt watched figments of memories flash across the field.
"Have you spoken to the supply masters? We're out of food, Egwene. We can't win a protracted war, fighting and falling back. The enemy will overwhelm us if we do that, just like Aiel and the marches of Maganda. We are at our strongest now. Broken though we are. Fall back, and we resign ourselves to starvation as the Trollocs destroy us."
"Rand," Egwene said. "We just have to hold out until he is victorious."
"That's true in a fashion," Matt said, turning toward the heights. In his mind's eye he saw what could come, the possibilities. He imagined riders on the heights, like shadows. He would lose if he tried to hold those heights, but maybe...
"If Rand loses, it won't matter. The wheel is bloody broken and we all become nothing if we're lucky. Well, we can't do anything more about it. But here's the thing. If he does what he's supposed to, we could still lose. We will lose if we don't stop the Shadow's armies."
He blinked, seeing it. The entire battlefield spread before him. Fighting at the ford, arrows from the palisade.
"We can't just beat them, Egwene," Matt said. "We can't just stand and hold on. We have to destroy them, drive them away, then hunt them to the last Trolloc. We can't just survive. We have to win."
"How are we going to do that?" Egwene asked. "Matt, you're not talking sense. Weren't you just saying yesterday how outnumbered we'll be?"
He looked toward the bog, imagining shadows trying to slog through it. Shadows of dust and memory.
"I have to change it all," he said.
He could not do what they would expect. He could not do what spies might have reported he was planning.
"Blood and bloody ashes. One last toss of the dice. Everything we have... piled into a heap."
A group of men in dark armor came through a gateway to the top of the knob, panting deeply as if they'd had to chase down a Damani to get them up here. Their breastplates were lacquered a deep red, but this batch did not need a fearsome display to be frightening. They looked furious enough to scramble eggs with a stare.
"You,"
said the lead Death Watch guard, a man named Galen, pointing at Matt.
"Are needed at the..."
Matt held up a hand to cut him off.
"I will not be denied again," Galen said. "I have orders from..."
Matt shot the man a glare, and he stopped short. Matt turned northward again. A cool, somehow familiar wind blew across him, rippling his long coat, brushing at his hat. He narrowed his eye. Rand was tugging on him. The dice still tumbled in his head. "They're here," Matt said.
"What did you say?" Egwene asked.
"They're here."
The scouts
are wrong," Matt said. He looked up and noticed a pair of Rockans speeding back toward the camp. They had seen it. The Trollocs must have marched through the night.
"Sharns will come first," Matt thought, "to give the Trollocs a breather. They'll have arrived through gateways."
"Send runners," Matt said, pointing at the Death Watch guards. "Get the men and women to their posts, and warn Elaine that I'm going to change the battle plan."
"What?"
Egwene said.
"They're here," Matt said, turning on the guards. "Why aren't you bloody running? Go! Go!"
Above, the Rockan screeched. Galen, to his credit, saluted, then ran, pounding in that massive armor, with his companions.
"This is it, Egwene," Matt said. "Take a deep breath. A last pull on the brandy or burn your final pinch of tobacco. Have a good look at the ground before you, as it's soon going to be covered in blood. In an hour, we'll be in the thick of it. The light watch over us all."
Perrin drifted in darkness. He felt so tired.
"Slayer still lives," a piece of him thought. "Grendel is corrupting the great captains. The end is near. You can't slip away now. Hold on."
Hold on to what? He tried to open his eyes, but was so exhausted. He should have gotten out of the wolf dream sooner. His entire body felt numb, except for his side. Moving fingers that felt like bricks, he touched the warmth. His hammer. It was blazing hot. That warmth seemed to move up his fingers, and Perrin took a deep breath. He needed to wake up. He hovered at the edges of consciousness, as when he was close to sleep, but still partially aware. In that state, he felt as if he faced a forked pathway before him. One path led deeper into darkness, and one led... he couldn't see, but he knew that it meant... it meant waking up. Warmth from the hammer radiated up his arm. His mind gathered sharpness.
"Awaken."
That was what Slayer had done. He had awakened somehow. Perrin's life was trickling away. Not much time left. Half within death's embrace, he gritted his teeth, drew in a deep breath, and forced himself to wake. The silence of the wolf dream shattered. Perrin hit soft earth and entered a place of shouts. Something about a battlefront, about preparing the lines. Nearby, someone cried out, and then someone else and others.
"Perrin?"
He knew that voice.
"Perrin, lad."
"Master Luhan?" Perrin's eyelids felt so heavy, he couldn't open them. Arms grabbed him.
"Hang on. I have you, lad. I have you. Hang on."
Chapter 37. The Last Battle. Dawn broke that morning on Polov Heights, but the sun did not shine on the defenders of light. Out of the west and out of the north came the armies of darkness to win this one last battle and cast a shadow across the earth, to usher in an age where the wails of suffering would go unheard. From the notebook of Loyal, son of Arendt, son of Halon, the Fourth Age. Lan held his sword aloft as he galloped Mandarb through camp. Above, the morning clouds began to bleed red, reflecting enormous fireballs rising from the massive Sharan army that was approaching from the west. They arced in the sky gracefully, seeming slow because of the great distance. Groups of riders broke out of the camp, joining Lan. The remaining Malkieri rode just behind him, but his force had swelled like a tide. Andir joined him at the front, the flag of Malkir, the golden crane, acting as a banner for all of the borderlands. They had been bloodied, but not beaten. Knock a man down and you saw what he was made of. That man might run. If he didn't, if he stood back up with blood at the corner of his mouth and determination in his eyes, then you knew. That man was about to become truly dangerous. The fireballs seemed to move more quickly as they dropped, crashing to the camp in bursts of red fury. Explosions shook the ground. Nearby, screams rose to accompany the thunder of hoofbeats. Still, men joined him. Matt Cawthon had spread word through all of the camps that more cavalry were needed to join Land's advance and replace lost soldiers. He had also disclosed the cost of doing so. The cavalry would be at the forefront of the fighting, breaking Trolloc and Sharan lines, and would find little rest. They'd carry the brunt of the casualties this day. Still, men joined him. Borderlanders who should have been too old to ride, merchants who had put aside the money pouch and taken up the sword, a surprising number of southerners, including many women, wearing breastplates and steel or leather caps, carrying spears. There weren't enough lances to go around.
"Half of those joining look like farmers more than soldiers," Andir called to him over the hoofbeats.
"Have you ever seen a man or woman from the Two Rivers ride, Andir?"
Lan yelled back.
"I can't say that I have. Watch, and be surprised."
Lan's cavalry reached the River Mora, where a man with long, curling hair wearing a black coat stood with hands clasped behind his back. Loghain now had 40 Aes Sedai and Ashaman with him. He eyed Lan's force, then raised a hand toward the sky, crumpling an enormous falling fireball as if it were a piece of paper. The sky cracked like lightning, and the breaking fireball gushed sparks to every side, smoke churning in the air. Ashes drifted down, burning out, hitting the rushing river and scattering black and white on its surface. Lan slowed Mandar as he approached Howell Ford, just south of the heights. Loghain thrust his other hand toward the river. The waters churned, then lurched up into the air as if flowing over an invisible ramp. They crashed down on the other side, a violent waterfall, while some of the water spilled over the banks of the river. Lan nodded to Loghain, and continued on, guiding Mandarb under the waterfall and crossing the still wet rocks of the ford. Sunlight filtered through the river waters above, sparkling down on Lan as he thundered through the tunnel, Andir and the Melchieri behind him. The waterfall roared down to his left, spraying a mist of water. Lan shivered as he burst back out into the light, then charged through the corridor toward the Sharans. To his right rose the heights. To his left, the bogs. But there was a passage of solid, level ground here. Up on the heights, archers, crossbowmen, and dragoners prepared to release volleys at the oncoming foes. Sharans at the front, a huge force of Trollocs gathering up behind, all directly west of the heights. The thunder of dragon fire shook the air from the top of the heights, and soon the Sharans had explosions of their own to contend with. Lan set his lance, took aim at a Sharan soldier charging toward Polov Heights, then braced himself.
Elaine whipped her head up, turning to the side. That terrible song, a croon, a hum, beautiful yet terrible at the same time. She heeled Moonshadow, drawn toward that soft sound. Where was it? It rose from somewhere deeper in the Shanshan camp, at the base of Dashar Knob. Chewing out Matt for not telling her his plan of war could wait. She needed to find the source of that sound, that wonderful sound, that—
Elaine, Birgitta said.
Elaine kicked her horse forward.
Elaine, Drakkar.
Drakkar. Elaine shook herself, then looked up to find the creatures falling like drops of water into the camp around them. Guardswomen lowered their swords, eyes opening wide as the crooning continued. Elaine wove a thunderclap. It burst from her, splitting the air, washing across the guardswomen and making them cry out and cover their ears. Pain stabbed Elaine's head and she cursed, closing her eyes at the shock. And then she heard nothing. That was the point. She forced her eyes open to see Drakkar all around with their spindly bodies and inhuman eyes. They opened their lips to croon, but Elaine's deafened ears could not hear the song. She smiled, then wove whips of fire, striking the creatures down. She could not hear their screeches of pain, which was a pity. Elaine's guardswomen rallied, rising from knees, lowering hands from ears. She could tell from their dazed looks that they had been deafened. Birgitta soon had them striking at the surprised Drakkar. Three of the creatures tried to leap up and fly away, but Birgitta took each one with a white-fletched arrow, dropping the last so that it crashed into a nearby tent. Elaine waved, getting Birgitta's attention. The first Drakkar sounds hadn't come from above, but from farther into camp. Elaine pointed, kicking Moonshadow into motion, leading her troops among the Shanshan. All about, men lay staring into the sky, mouths open. Many seemed to be breathing, but they stared with dead eyes. The Drakkar had consumed their souls but left the bodies alive, like the crust cut off a rich man's bread. Sloppy. This group of Drakkar, like there were well over 100 of them, could have taken a man each, killed him, then retreated before their presence was discovered. The distant roars of the battle, the bleating horns, the booming dragons, the hissing fireballs, all of which Elaine now felt, but could only barely make out with her broken ears, had covered the Drakkar attack. The creatures could have struck and fled, but they were greedy. Her guards scattered, hacking at the surprised Drakkar, many of whom were holding soldiers. The beasts were not strong fighters, if measured by strength of arm. Elaine waited, preparing weaves. Those Drakkar who tried to flee, she burned from the sky. Once the last of them were dead, at least the ones they could see, Elaine waved Birgitta to approach. The air smelled sharply of burned flesh. Elaine wrinkled her nose and reached down from horseback to take Birgitta's head in her hands, healing the woman's ears. The babes kicked as she did so. Did they react to times when she healed someone? Or was that her fancy? Elaine reached down to hold her stomach with one arm as Birgitta stepped back, looking about. The warder knocked an arrow and Elaine felt her alarm. Birgitta loosed, and a Drakkar stumbled back from cover inside a nearby tent. A Shanshan stumbled out, eyes glassed over. The feeding had been interrupted halfway through. The poor fellow would never be right in the mind again. Elaine turned her horse and saw some Shanshan troops charging into the area. Birgitta spoke to them, then turned to speak to Elaine. Elaine just shook her head, and Birgitta hesitated, then said something else to the Shanshan. Elaine's guards grouped around her again, watching the Shanshan with distrust. Elaine understood the sentiment perfectly. Birgitta waved her forward, and they continued on in the direction they had been going. As they did, a Demonian Suldam approached and, surprisingly, curtsied to Elaine. Perhaps this Fortuona had given them orders to respect foreign monarchs. Elaine hesitated, but what was she going to do? She could return to her own camp for healing, but that would take time, and it was urgent that she speak with Matt. What was the point of spending days drawing up war plans if he was going to throw them aside? She trusted him, like she had to, but she'd still rather know what he intended to do. She sighed, then held out her foot to the Damani. The woman frowned, then glanced to the Suldam. Both seemed to take it as an insult. Elaine had certainly intended it as one. The Suldam nodded, and her Damani reached to touch Elaine's leg just above her booted foot. Elaine's sturdy boots looked like something a soldier would wear, not a queen, but she didn't intend to ride into battle wearing slippers. A small icy shock of healing ran through her, and her hearing returned slowly. The low pitches returned first. Explosions. The distant boom of dragon fire. The rush of the river nearby. several Seanchan talking. Mid-ranges came next, then a flood of sounds. Flaps rustling, screams of soldiers, calls of horns. "Tell them to heal the others," Elaine said to Birgitta. Birgitta raised an eyebrow, probably wondering why Elaine wouldn't just give the order herself. Well, these Seanchan paid very close attention to which people could speak to one another. Elaine would not give them the honor of speaking to them directly. Birgitta relayed the order, and the Suldam's lips drew to a line. She'd had the sides of her hair shaved. She was high-born. Light-willing, Elaine had managed to insult her again.
"I will do it," the woman said. "Though why any of you would want to be healed by an animal is beyond me."
The Seanchan didn't believe in letting Damani heal. At least, that was what they kept claiming. That hadn't stopped them from reluctantly teaching the weaves to their captive women, now that they'd seen firsthand what an advantage it was in battle. From what Elaine had heard, the highborn rarely accepted that healing, however. "Let's go," Elaine said, riding forward. She waved for her soldiers to stay behind and be healed. Birgitta eyed her, but did not object. The two of them hurried on, Birgitta mounting her horse and riding with Elaine toward the Seanchan command building. One story, perhaps the size of a small farmhouse, it sat in a large, high-walled cleft at the southern base of Dashar Knob. They'd moved it from the top, as Matt worried it would be too exposed. The top would continue to be used for overseeing the battle at short intervals. Elaine allowed Birgitta to help her dismount. Light, but she was starting to feel unwieldy. It was as if she were a ship in dry dock. She took a moment to properly compose herself. Smooth features, emotions in control. She picked at her hair, straightened her dress, then walked into the building. "What?" she bellowed as she stepped in. "In the name of a bloody two-fingered trollic haystack grunter do you think you are doing, Matrim Coffin?" Unsurprisingly, the curse made the man grin as he looked up from the map table. He wore his hat and coat over some very nice silken clothing that looked as if it had been tailored to match the hat's color, and to include tooled leather at the cuffs and collar so as to not be so out of place. It smelled of some kind of compromise. Why was his hat banded with pink ribbon, though? "Hello, Elaine," Matt said. "I figured that I could look forward to seeing you soon." He waved to a chair, bearing the red and gold of Andor at the side of the room. It was extra cushioned, with a cup of warm tea steaming on the stand beside it. "Burn you, Matrim Coffin," she thought. "When did you grow so clever?" The Seanchan Empress sat on her own throne at the head of the room, Min at her side, draped in enough green silk to supply a shop in Camelin for 2 weeks. Elaine did not miss the fact that Fortuona's throne was 2 fingers higher than Elaine's. Bloody insufferable woman. "Matt, there are Drakkar in your camp." "Burn it," he said. "Where?" "I should say there were Drakkar in your camp," Elaine said. "We dealt with them. You need to tell your archers to keep better watch." "I've told them," Matt complained. "Bloody ashes. Somebody check on the archers.
Great prince,"
a Seanchan messenger said, skidding through the doorway. He went to his knees, then prostrated himself with a smooth motion, never stopping his narrative.
"Archer Bank is down, hit by Sharan outriders. They masked their attack by smoke from fireballs."
"Blood and bloody ashes," Matt said. "Send 16 Damani and Suldam down there now. Send to the northern archery units and bring squads 42 and 50 down. And tell the scouts I'll have them flogged if they let anything like this happen again."
"Great one,"
the scout said, saluting and scrambling to his feet, backing out of the room without looking up, to avoid the risk of meeting Matt's gaze. All in all, Elaine was impressed by how easily the scout mixed his obeisance and his report. She was also sickened. No ruler should demand such of her subjects. A nation's strength came from the strength of its people. Break them and you were breaking your own back. You knew I was coming, Elaine said after Matt gave a few more orders to his aides. And you anticipated the anger your changing of plans would cause. Burn you, Matrim Cawthon. Why did you feel the need to do this? I thought our battle plan was sound. It was, Matt said. Then why change it? Elaine, Matt said, glancing at her. Everyone put me in charge, against my will. Because I can't have my mind changed by the Forsaken, right? That was the general idea, Elaine said. Though I guess it has less to do with that medallion of yours and more to do with you having too thick a head for compulsion to penetrate. Bloody right, Matt said. Anyway, if the Forsaken are using compulsion on people in our camps, they probably have a few spies in our meetings. I suppose so. So they know our plan. Our great plan that we spent so long preparing. They know it. Elaine hesitated. Light, Matt said, shaking his head. The first and most important rule to winning a war is knowing what your enemy is going to do. I thought the first rule was to know your terrain, Elaine said, folding her arms. That too. Anyway, I realize that if the enemy knows what we're going to do, we have to change, immediately. Bad battle plans are better than ones your enemy will anticipate. Why didn't you guess this would happen? Elaine demanded. He looked at her, expressionless. One side of his mouth twitched up. Then he pulled his hat down, shading his eye patch. Light, Elaine said. You knew. You spent this whole week planning with us, and you knew the entire time you'd throw it out with the dishwater. That's giving me too much bloody credit, Matt said, looking back at his maps. I think a part of me might have known all along, but I didn't figure it out until just before the Sharons got here. So what is the new plan? He didn't reply. You're going to keep it in your head, Elaine said, her legs feeling weak. You're going to lead the battle, and none of us are going to know what in the light you're planning, are we? Otherwise someone might overhear, and the news would travel to the shadow. He nodded. Creator, shelter us, she whispered. Matt scowled. You know, that's what Tuon said.
On the heights, Uno held his ears as the nearby dragons belched fire at the Trollocs and Sharons west of them. The scent of something pungent burned in the air, and the blasts were so deafening he couldn't hear his own bloody cursing. Down below, Landmandragoran's riders were sweeping the sides of the assault force, keeping them contained so that the dragons could do more damage. The Sharons had Trollocs with them. They had channelers with them, too. Lots of them. Farther upriver, another large army of Trollocs, the ones that had done so much damage to Daishan's forces, had come down from the northeast and would soon reach the field of Marilor. The dragons stilled momentarily, the dragoners stuffing the maws again with whatever it was that made them work. Uno wasn't going to step bloody close to them. Bad luck, those were. He was certain of it. The leader of the dragoners was a wiry Kyrianin, and Uno had never had much use for those folk. They bloody scowled at him whenever he talked. This one sat haughtily upon his horse and didn't flinch when the dragons fired again. The Amarlin Seat had thrown her lot in with these men and with the Seanchan, too. Uno wasn't going to flaming complain. They needed every sword they could get, Kyrianin and bloody Seanchan included.
You like our dragons, Captain? The leader, Talmanis, called to Uno.
Captain. Uno had bloody been promoted. He now led a force of newly recruited Tower pikemen and light cavalry. He shouldn't have been in charge of bloody anything. He had been happy as a regular soldier. But he had both training and battle experience, things that were in slim supply these days, or so Queen Elaine had said. So now he was a flaming officer, and leading cavalry and foot soldiers, no less. Well, he knew his way around a pike if he had to use one, though he usually preferred to fight on horseback. His men were ready to defend the rim of the heights should the enemy make it up the slope. So far, the archers situated in front of the dragoners had prevented that. But soon enough, the archers would have to pull back, and then it would be bloody regular soldiers doing the bloody fighting. Below, the Sharans pulled aside to let the main Trolloc forces storm up onto the slope. The pikemen would advance, resisting the Trolloc attack, and pikes would work well here, as the Trollocs would be pushing uphill. Add in some flaming cavalry on their flanks and some bloody archers shooting through those gateways made high up in the air, and they could probably sit here for days, maybe weeks. When they were pushed off by superior numbers, they'd let go inch by inch, clinging to every speck of ground. Uno figured there was no way he was going to survive this flaming battle. He was surprised he'd made it this long. Really, Flaming Massima should have had his head, or the Seanchan near Falma, or a Trolloc here and there. He had tried to keep himself lean so he'd taste flaming terrible when they stuffed him in one of those flaming cookpots. The dragons fired again, blasting enormous holes in the hordes of advancing Trollocs. Uno clapped his hands to his ears.
"Warn a man when you do that, you flaming bits hanging from her goats!"
The next shot drowned him out. The Trollocs below were blown into the air, the dragons pulverizing the ground beneath them. Those eggs exploded once they were shot from those cursed tubes. What kind of thing other than the One Power could make metal explode? Uno was certain he flaming didn't want to know. Talmanis stepped up to the rim of the heights, inspecting the damage. He was joined by a Terrabonner woman, the one who had invented these weapons. She looked over and saw Uno, then tossed him something. A small bit of wax. The Terrabonner woman tapped her ear, then began speaking with Talmanis, gesturing. He might have command of the troops, but the woman had charge of the devices. She told the men where to position the dragons to fight. Uno grumbled, but pocketed the wax. A fist of Trollocs had pushed through the blast, about 100 strong, and he didn't have time to bother with his ears. Uno grabbed a pike, leveling it and signaling for his men to do the same. They all wore the white of the tower. Uno himself wore a white tabard. He shouted orders, readying his pike by standing sideways near the top of the slope, the heel of its shaft raised. One hand gripped the shaft in front of him to guide and reinforce the thrust. The other hand, palm down, gripping it an arm's length from the heel, would drive home the thrust as the Trollocs came into range. Several ranks of pikemen behind Uno stood ready to advance following the initial impact.
"Steady with the pikes, you flaming sheep-herders!"
Uno bellowed.
"Steady!"
The Trollocs scrambled up the hill, crashing into the line of pikes. The beasts in the vanguard tried to knock the pikes aside with sweeps of their weapons, but Uno's men stepped forward, skewering Trollocs, often two pikes per beast. Uno grunted, pulling his pike back into line to catch a Trolloc through the throat.
"First rank, back!"
Uno yelled, pulling his pike backward to free it from the Trolloc he'd killed. His companions did the same, pulling their weapons free and leaving the corpses to roll down the slope. The pikemen in the front rank fell back as those in the second rank came forward between them, ramming pikes into snarling Trollocs. Each rank rotated up front in succession until minutes later the entire group of Trollocs was dead.
"Nice work,"
Uno said, raising his pike to the upright position, a trickle of rancid Trolloc blood winding down the shaft from the pike head.
"Nice work."
He glanced toward the dragoners, who were feeding more eggs down those tubes. He hastily pulled the wax out of his pocket.
Yes, they could hold this flaming position. They could hold it well. They just needed to...
A cry from up above stopped him from putting the wax in. Something thumped to the ground beside Uno. A lead ball with streamers dropped from high up.
"Flaming Seanchan goat!"
Uno yelled, looking up and shaking his fist.
"That nearly took me in the crown, you lover of rotting worms!"
The rockin flew off, probably without its rider hearing a word of what Uno had shouted. "Bloody Seanchan!" He stooped down, removing the letter from the ball. "Retreat down the southwestern slope of the heights."
"You're bloody kicking me," Uno muttered. "Kicking me in the head while I'm sleeping. Alan, you bloody fool, can you read this?"
Alan, a dark-haired Anderman, wore a half-beard, shaved at the sides. Uno had always thought those looked flaming ridiculous.
"Retreat,"
Alan said. "Now?"
"They've flaming lost their minds," Uno said.
Nearby, Talmanis and the Terrabonner woman were receiving a messenger, and she was relaying the same news by the looks of the Terrabonner woman's scowl. Retreat.
"Cawthon had better bloody know what he's doing," Uno said, shaking his head.
He still didn't understand why anyone would put Cawthon in charge of anything. He remembered that boy, always snapping at people, eyes sunken in his head, half-dead, half-spoiled. Uno shook his head. But he'd do it. He'd sworn to the bloody White Tower, so he'd do it.
"Pass the word,"
he said to Alan, stuffing the wax in his ears as Aludra, at the dragons, prepared a last volley before leaving.
"We're pulling back from the bloody heights and—"
A clap of sound hit Uno physically, vibrating through him, bloody near stopping his heart. His head hit the ground before he realized he'd fallen. He blinked dust from his eyes, groaning and rolling over as another flash, then another struck the heights where the dragons were. Lightning. His soldiers were down on their knees, eyes shut, hands over ears. Talmanis was already up, however, shouting orders that Uno could barely hear, waving for his men to pull back. A dozen fireballs, enormous and incredibly fast, rose from the Sharan army behind the Trollocs. Uno cursed and threw himself in a depression for cover, rolling into place moments before the entire hill shook like an earthquake. Clods of earth fell upon him, almost burying him. Everything was coming at them. Everything. Every bloody Sharan channeler in the army seemed to focus on the heights at once. His people had Aes Sedai, placed to protect the dragons, but from the look of things, they would be hard-pressed to fight back against that. The attack lasted for what seemed an eternity. When it subsided, Uno crawled free. Some of the flaming dragons were in pieces, and Aludra was working with the dragoners to salvage those and protect the rest. Talmanis, holding a bloody hand to his head, was shouting. Uno pried the wax from one of his ears, that had probably saved his hearing, and scrambled toward Talmanis.
"Where are your bloody Aes Sedai?" Uno shouted. "They're bloody supposed to be stopping this."
They had 4 dozen of them, ordered to cut weaves from the air or knock them aside to protect the dragons. They had claimed to be able to keep the heights safe from anything but the coming of the Dark One. Now they were in shambles, the lightning strikes having fallen in their midst. The Trollocs were advancing up the hill again. Uno ordered Alan to form the pike wall and hold the creatures back, then ran toward the Aes Sedai with a few guards. He joined warders, helping the women up, looking for their leader.
"Quamesa Sedai?"
Uno asked, finding the Aes Sedai in charge who was dusting herself off. The slender, dark-haired Arafelin was muttering softly under her breath.
"What was that?"
she demanded.
Uno said.
"That question wasn't intended for you," she said, scanning the sky.
"Einar! Why didn't you spot those weaves?"
An Ashaman rushed over.
"They came so quickly. They were upon us before I had time to give warning. And light, whoever sent them, was strong. Stronger than I've ever seen. Stronger than—"
A line of light split the air behind them. It was enormous, as long as the keep of Feldara. It rotated upon itself, opening a vast gateway that split the ground at the center of the heights. Standing on the other side was a man in brilliant armor made of silver coin-like rings, his helmetless head bearing dark hair and a strong nose. He held before him a scepter of gold, the top shaped like an hourglass or a fine goblet. Quamesa reacted immediately, raising her hand and releasing a stream of fire. The man waved his hand and the stream of fire deflected. Then he pointed, almost indifferently, in something thin, hot, and white connected him to Quamesa. Her form glowed, and then she was gone, motes drifting toward the ground. Uno jumped away, Einar joining him as he rolled behind the rubble of a broken dragon.
"I come for the dragon reborn," the figure in silver announced. "You will send for him. Either that or I will see that your screams bring him."
The ground beneath the dragons heaved into the air just a few feet from Uno. He threw his arm up in front of his face, bits of wooden soil flying across him.
"Light, help us," Einar said. "I'm trying to stop him, but he's in a circle. A full circle. 72. I've never seen such power before. I..."
A bar of white-hot light cut through the broken dragon, vaporizing it and striking Einar. The man was gone in an instant, and Uno scrambled back, cursing. He ducked away as the wreckage of dragons crashed to the ground around him. Uno yelled for his men to fall back, whipping them into motion, delaying only long enough to grab a wounded man under the arm and help him away. He no longer questioned the order to retreat from the heights. It was the finest bloody order any man had ever given. Loghain Ablar released the One Power. He stood beside the Mora, below the heights, and felt the attacks up above. Releasing the One Power today was one of the most difficult things he'd ever done. More difficult than the decision to name himself Dragon. More difficult than keeping himself from strangling Taim during their early days together in the Black Tower. The power drained out of him, as if his veins had been opened, and he was bleeding out across the ground. He took a deep breath. Holding that much of the One Power, that of 39 people in a circle, had been intoxicating. Letting go reminded him of his gentling, when the power had been stolen from him, when every breath had encouraged him to find a knife and slit his own throat. He suspected this was his madness, the terror that releasing the One Power would cause him to lose it forever.
"Loghain?"
Andral asked. Loghain turned his head toward the shorter man and his companions. They were loyal. Loghain didn't know why, but they were loyal. The whole lot of them. Fools. Faithful fools.
"Can you feel that?"
Andral asked. The others, Canler, Imaran, Jonath, were staring at the heights, the power being released there. It was amazing.
"Demandred," Imaran said. "It must be him."
Loghain nodded slowly. Such power. Even one of the Forsaken could not be so strong. He must carry a Sa-Angreal of immense strength. "With such a tool," his thoughts whispered, "no man or woman could ever take the power from you again." Taim had done it during Loghain's imprisonment. Held him captive, shielded, unable to touch the One Power. The attempts to turn him had been painful, crushing. But being without Saidin... Strength, he thought, watching that powerful channeling. The lust to be so strong almost drowned out his hatred of Taim.
"For now we will not engage him," Loghain said. "Split yourselves into the prearranged teams."
Those would be one woman and 5 or 6 men in each team. The woman and 2 men could form a circle, while the other 2 offered support.
"We will hunt the traitors of the Black Tower."
Pivara, standing at Andral's side, raised an eyebrow.
"You mean to go hunting Taim already? Didn't Cauthen want you here to help move men?"
"I've made it clear to Cauthen," Loghain said. "I will not spend this battle delivering soldiers around the field. As for orders, we have a directive from the Dragon Reborn himself."
Randall Thor had called them his last orders for them, a note delivered with a small Angreal of a man holding a sword. "The Shadow has stolen the seals of the Dark One's prison. Find them. If you can, please find them." During their captivity, Andral had heard what he thought was Taim bragging about the seals. It was their only lead. Loghain scanned the distance. Their forces were retreating from the heights. Loghain could not see the array of dragons from where he stood, but the thick lines of smoke did not speak well for their safety.
"He still gives orders," Loghain thought. "Am I inclined to obey them any longer?"
With a chance at revenge on Taim? Yes, he would follow Randall Thor's orders. Once he wouldn't have questioned doing nearly as much. That had been before his captivity and torture.
"Go," Loghain said to his Ashaman. "You have read what the Lord Dragon wrote.
We must recover the seals at all costs. Nothing is more important than this. We must hope that Taim indeed has them. Watch for signs of men channeling. Hunt them. Kill them.
It didn't matter if those men channeling were Sharans. The Ashaman would help this battle by removing enemy channelers anyway. They had discussed the tactic earlier. When they sensed channeling from men, they could use gateway jumps to pinpoint where they were, then try to surprise them and attack.
"If you see one of Taim's men," Logan said, "try to capture him so we can pry out of him where Taim has set up his base."
He paused.
"If we're lucky, the Mahail himself will be here. Be wary that he might be carrying the seals. It would not do to destroy them in our attack. If you see him, return and bring me word of his location."
Logain's teams moved off. They left him with Gabrella, R.L. Malavin, and Carlden Manfor. It was well that at least some of his more skilled men had been absent from the tower during Taim's betrayal. Gabrella looked at Logain with level eyes.
"What of Tovain?" she asked.
"We will kill her if we find her."
"It is that simple for you?"
"Yes. She... would you rather live, Gabrella, if you were she? Live and serve him?"
She closed her mouth, lips drawn tight. She still feared him. He could sense that.
"Good."
"Was this what you wished for?" his mind whispered. "When you raised the banner of the dragon? When you sought to save mankind? Did you do it to be feared? Hated?" He ignored that voice. The only times he had accomplished anything in life had come when he'd been feared. It was the only edge he'd had against Swan and Liana. The primal Logain, that something deep inside that drove him to keep living, needed people to fear him.
"Can you sense her?" Gabrella asked.
"I released the bond."
Her envy was sharp and immediate. It shocked him. He had thought that she was beginning to enjoy, or at least suffer, their place together. But, of course, it was all an act so that she could try to manipulate him. That was the Aes Sedai way. Yes, he felt lust from her before, perhaps even affection. He wasn't certain he could trust what he thought he'd felt from her. It seemed that, for all he had tried to be strong and free, his strings had been pulled since he'd been a youngling. Demondred's channeling radiated strength. Such power! A loud boom sounded from the heights. Logain laughed, throwing his head back. Bodies, like leaves, were thrown off the heights and into the air.
"Link to me," he commanded those who remained with him. "Join me in a circle, and let us hunt the Mahail and his men as well. Light send that I can find him. My table deserves only the finest of meat. The head stag himself."
And after that, who knew? He had always wanted to test himself against one of the Forsaken. Logain seized the source again, holding to the thrashings of Saiyadin as if it were a serpent writhing and trying to bite him. He used his Ongrial to draw more, and then the power from the others streamed into him. He laughed louder. Gawain felt so tired. This week of preparation would normally have rested him, but he felt today as if he'd hiked for tens of leagues. There was no helping it. He forced his attention toward the gateway and the table in front of him, overlooking the battlefield.
"You're certain they cannot see this?" he asked Yukiri. "I'm certain," she replied. "It has been tested exhaustively."
She was becoming skilled with these viewing gateways. She had created this one on top of a table brought through to their camp from Tarvalin. He was looking down at the battleground as he would a map.
"If you have truly made the other side invisible," Egwene said speculatively, "this might be useful indeed." "It would be easier to spot from up close," Yukiri admitted. "This one is so high in the sky that nobody below will be able to make it out."
Gawain didn't like Egwene standing there, head and shoulders hanging out over the battlefield. He held his tongue. The gateway was as safe as they could make it. He couldn't protect her from everything.
Light, Bryn said softly. They're cutting us to pieces.
Gawain glanced at him. The man rebuffed suggestions, even strong ones, that he return to his estates. He insisted that he was still capable of holding a sword. He just couldn't be allowed to lead. Besides, he argued, any of them could be under compulsion. In a way, knowing that he was gave them an advantage. At least they could watch him. And Swan did, holding to his arm protectively. The only others in the tent were Sylviana and Doacine. The battle was not going well. Cawthon had lost the heights already. The original plan had been to hold there as long as possible, and the dragons were in pieces. Demandred's attack with the One Power had come far more powerfully than any of them had anticipated. And the other large Trolloc army had arrived from the northeast and were pressing Cawthon's defenders upriver.
"What is he planning?" Egwene said, tapping the side of the table.
Distant yells drifted through the opening.
"If this keeps up, our armies are going to be surrounded."
"He's trying to bait the trap," Bryn said.
"What kind of trap?"
"It is a guess," Bryn said, "and Light knows my own assessment cannot be trusted as it once was. It looks like Cawthon is planning to heap everything into one battle, no delaying, no trying to wear the Trollocs down. The way this is going, it will be decided in days, maybe hours."
"That sounds exactly like something Matt would do," Egwene said, resigned.
"The strength of those weaves," Lelaine said. "That power!"
"Demandred is in a circle," Egwene said. "Eyewitnesses say a full circle, something that hasn't been seen since the Age of Legends. And he has a saw, Angreal. Some of the soldiers saw it. A scepter." Gawain watched the fighting far below, his hand on his sword. He could hear men scream as Demandred aimed wave after wave of fire at them. The Forsaken's voice boomed suddenly, reaching high into the air.
"Where are you, Luz Theron? You were seen at each of the other battlefields in disguise. Are you here too? Fight me!"
Gawain's hand tightened on his sword. Soldiers flooded down the southwestern side of the heights to cross the ford. A few small groups held on the slopes, and dragoners there, tiny as insects to Gawain, led the remaining dragons to safety, pulled by mules. Demandred flung destruction at the fleeing troops. He was an army unto himself, hurling bodies into the air, exploding horses, burning and destroying. Around him his Trollocs seized the high ground. Their brutish cheers floated through the gateway.
"We're going to have to deal with him, Mother," Sylviana said.
"Soon."
"He's just trying to draw us out," Egwene said. "He has that saw, Angreal. We could build a circle of 72 ourselves, but what then? Fall into his trap? Be slaughtered?"
"What choice have we, Mother?" Lelaine asked.
"Light, he's killing thousands."
Killing thousands. And here they stood. Gawain stepped back. Nobody seemed to notice his withdrawal, other than Yukiri, who eagerly stepped up and took his place beside Egwene. Gawain slipped out of the tent, and when the tent guards glanced at him, said he needed some fresh air. Egwene would approve. She sensed how tired he was lately. She'd mentioned it to him several times. His eyelids felt as if they had weights of iron pulling them down. Gawain looked toward the blackened sky. He could hear the distant booms. How long would he just stand around and do nothing while men died?
"You promised," he thought to himself. "You said you were willing to stand in her shadow."
That didn't mean he had to stop doing important work, did it? He fished in his pouch and took out a ring of the blood knives. He put it on, and immediately his strength returned, his exhaustion fleeing. He hesitated, then took out the other rings and slipped them on as well. On the south bank of the River Mora, in front of the ruins northeast of Dashar Nob, Tam-el-Thor summoned the void as Kimtin had taught him all of those years ago. Tam imagined the single flame and poured his emotions into it. He grew calm. Then the calmness left him,
leaving nothing. Like a newly painted wall, beautiful and white, that had just been washed. Everything melted away. Tam was the void. He drew his bow, the good black yew bending, arrow to his cheek. He took aim, but this was only a formality. When he was this strongly within the void, the arrow would do exactly as he commanded. He didn't know this any more than the sun knew that it would rise or the branches knew that their leaves would fall. These were not things known. They were things that were. He released, bowstring snapping, arrow drilling through the air. Another followed, then another. He had five in the air at once, each one aimed in anticipation of the shifting winds. The first five Trollocs fell as they tried to make their way across one of several of the raft bridges they had managed to place on the river here. Trollocs hated water. Even shallow water daunted them. Whatever Matt had done to protect the river upstream, it was working for now, and the river was still flowing. The Shadow would try to stop it. Was trying to stop it. Occasionally a Trolloc or mule carcass floated past from far upriver. Tam continued to launch arrows, Abel and the other two riversmen joining him. Sometimes they aimed into the mass, not picking out an individual Trolloc, though that was rare. A regular soldier might shoot unsighted and assume his arrow would find flesh, but not a good Two Rivers archer. Arrows were cheap to soldiers, but not to woodsmen. Trollocs fell in waves. Beside Tam and the Two Rivers men, crossbowmen cranked their weapons and loosed wave after wave into the shadow spawn. Fades behind whipped at the Trollocs, trying to urge them across the river, with little success. Tam's arrow hit a fade right where its eyes should have been. Nearby, a large man named Baird whistled in appreciation, leaning on his axe and watching the arrows fall. He was part of the group of soldiers set just behind the archers to move in and protect them once the Trollocs were forced to cross. Baird was one of the mercenary leaders who had drifted into the army, and though he was an Andoran, neither he nor the 100 or so men he led would speak of where they'd come from.